Hey everybody. Not much before we get into it tonight. Overmatch and older, but just as exciting, brother, our Blood Red Ivory are ready and waiting to join your recording list if they're not already on it. So far, you guys seem pretty happy with the addition of Billy West to the Benhoff universe. To answer the questions I'm getting, yes, I want to keep her around in the next installment of the series. And no, I have zero idea how I'm going to go about doing that yet. So stay tuned. New project just crested 50,000 words on the first draft, and it's expanding exponentially. The characters are doing what they do and kind of taking it in their own way. So next couple episodes, I'll explain more of what I'm going to do with that. But it's still coming together. But I've got over the hump. Once you're over 50K, it kind of feels like it's going to come together. So stay tuned for all of that. Tonight, let's get right into it. I'm a returning guest. Dr. Bill Kimberlin is joining me again. He was on very early on in the podcast. And to remind you guys all, doctor and author Bill Kimberlin has been researching and writing about death row and the execution process for well over a decade. He earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Criminal Justice, a Master of Arts degree in Counseling, and a doctorate in psychology. Dr. Kimberlin began his postdoctoral residency in psychology, but was most interested in understanding the worst of the worst criminal minds. This led him to focus on the psychology of those on death row and led to his book, Watch Me Die. In Watch Me Die, Dr. Kimberlin explores the grim realities of death row in Ohio and across America. He spends time interviewing inmates and eating meals with them. In some cases, he's the last person to speak with them before they die. From the moment they're placed on suicide watch until the moment they're executed, Kimberlin follows their twisted and complex journey through the execution process. Originally from Ohio, Bill and his wife Wendy and their two amazing children, Bailey and Mackenzie, now live in Florida. So thank you again for coming back to join me.
It's an honor. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's fascinating. It's fascinating what you do, and there's so much to talk about with it. Because, I mean, we were talking a little bit earlier about, a couple of the cases we discussed. You get 99.9% of people understand the people that you talk to through news clippings and ID discovery episodes and narratives that people want to tell about them, and then you actually take the time to sit down and discuss with them and know that world. So it's just fascinating what you do.
It really is. And it never started out this way. It was a rabbit hole I went down that I never really intended to. It was one of those things where I thought I'd go to death row once or twice just to learn enough to teach about. And, one of the guys there just happened to ask me, "Hey, do you I got an execution date coming up. You want to watch me die?" And I'm like, "Okay." And off to the races we went. And that's the reason the name of the book, and then the second edition, Watch Me Die, Last Words from Death Row, kind of expands on it a little bit more. And since then, for the last, 20 years now, it's all over the country. I go to, I've been to San Quentin and Florida's death row, every death row in Ohio, all over, witnessed multiple executions. I have 6 more that I've been asked to attend. One who's actually chosen the electric chair. These guys send me everything that you can think of in the mail, whether it's art or their MP3 players, their headphones, their IDs, they always try to one-up each other. So I think I probably have... pretty sure people have told me I have probably the largest collection of death row art in the country, if not worldwide, because I've never gotten rid of anything. My poor wife, Wendy, has to catalog it all whenever she has time. And I have thousands of pieces just laying around, stacked up. Some weeks I won't even go check my mailbox because, you do get burnt out from it, just like any other job. And people don't realize it, that it is, I'm not a hobbyist like a lot of those other ones you see on social media. It's not that I never want to glamorize these guys. 9 times out of 10, you'll never know when I post the art, just snippets of it. I don't put the names with them or anything like that because I don't want to glorify it or glamorize any of it. Where other ones, you know, they want to be seen more and they want to, I guess, brag about it. And I, to me, there's just nothing to brag about. It's a whole different subculture that when you dive into, you're enmeshed into it, and you better hope and pray that you've chosen the right line of work and know how to survive in their world and get out when you can. I mean, I've had them tell me flat out, you know, the guards will let me in. It's up to them to let me out. So,
yeah. And it's in, you know, the stress of that alone, but to recap for those who didn't hear the first time you were on, it was very interesting when you told me that, you know, you're teaching at a college and you're teaching the basics. If I get this right, let me know if I got it wrong. So you're teaching like the 101 classes, and you can talk about, you know, the various issues that affect our society, like the abortion issue, rights, voting, you know, the political environment, all these different social issues. And then when somebody asks you about public, you know, government sponsored execution, you're like, I think I need to brush up on this. So you took it upon yourself to get to know death row.
Yeah. Well, I always said I would never be the type of professor that would teach book smarts. So you're correct in the sense of teaching that way. And I was teaching, you know, abnormal psychology, social psychology, excuse me. And the same debatable political issues that are going on right now were going on back then. The abortion rights, the gun laws, legalization of drugs, capital punishments. And it's sad that all of those happen to be political issues. So, you know, and now living in the state of Florida in the past few years, you know, when Governor DeSantis was a presidential candidate, he started signing a lot of execution warrants for the first time. You know, so then I started seeing people that I knew on this death row get their dates. And, you know, you'll find that typically the more conservative red states are the ones that have the death penalty and utilize it. You know, that's why you see, you know, Texas and Florida and them doing it. Other states now have, and why we're even having this conversation in 2024 about the death penalty of, you know, different methods. You know, we just had the first nitrogen one. You know, so there's some controversy around that. You know, other states have enacted the firing squad. South Carolina, I think, was the latest one to do that. And I know Ohio was looking at it, but now that the nitrogen's a possibility, there's other states looking at it. Yet we still haven't been able to really fix any of the systems. So I don't know why they are trying to find a better method of killing somebody state sanctioned instead of, you know, fixing the underlying real issues out of it all.
Yeah. And that it's, you know, it's fascinating that you say that. It's, you know, we have it's not the issue of whether or not we allow the government to kill people. It's, you know, it's a very interesting, and it's not the best issue for it, but it's a great, very interesting to take a look at the United States and see that issue, as dark as it is a very interesting way of expressing the United States of America, because you've got a country with 50 different components, and such a severe issue as capital punishment is something that's decided state by state by state, and they all do it differently, and they do it under an umbrella precedent. But I mean, that's a very unique thing. That's very American, that there isn't this blanket, this is the United States. Yes, right. We do it. No, we don't do it. Or this is how we do it. It's like, well, the courts say we still do it. And all 50, you guys, right, just go figure out how you want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Figure out if you want to do it and then how you want to do it. And
yeah, if,
you know, yep. And it's a huge if. And, but in the meantime, you can't figure out national healthcare or national education or, you know, women's rights or things like that. So, it's bizarre to me to see how they turn and use human lives as a political chip maneuver, I guess, in a chess game. But everything in this society anymore is a chess game. And again, I'm not trying to convince people one way or the other to be pro capital punishment or you know, against it or anything like that. I just want people to have an informed, educated decision on when they make that opinion, other than what they read in the news articles or see on TV. And because I'm a big believer, you have to show the empirical evidence. You got to question everything. And I would challenge people to question me. You know, anything in the field of any science, you want to be questioned. Don't take my word for it. You know, read the book, see what you think, and then fire away. If you can shoot me down on what I have seen and stated in there as fact, then by all means do it. But at least become educated about it and not utilize these individuals on death row all over to profit from them or to just use as your own, I guess, pawns in a chess game, because that's what a lot of these hobbyists do. There's a lot of money to be made on death row.
We
were just talking about that a little earlier before we started the program, that, you know, there's a store over here that is a great, great people called Dysfunctional Grace, right outside of Tampa. And they heard about me, and I went over and I talked to them, and you know, they offered a huge, significant amount of money to purchase the letters and the art, because they know that people will pay top dollar for it. I get requests every day, you know, can you sell me anything from, you know, Scott Peterson or Charles Ng or Dennis Rader and people like, and I've never sold anything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I explain to people, if I sell stuff, then when I go into prisons and when I go to death row, there are no handcuffs, there's no shackles, no chains, there's none of that. And if they find out that I sold them out, you know, yeah. I almost had some issues with somebody tried to say that I sold out Glenn Rogers on death row here in Florida. And he's a pretty big known, you know, serial killer. And, you know, some say he was involved in the OJ stuff and all of that. And he had heard that I had sold him out, and I never did. But it turns out that people will say that so they can get closer to him and get their artwork or get their letters mm-hmm. or their signatures. I mean, when you get $150, $200 for a signature or an envelope, there's something deranged about that.
Yeah, and I mean, for you to have worked your way into the point of trust, and you've explained it to me before, I don't understand the Death Row Network, as you put it, but
yeah,
just, you know, put the morality of glorifying these people and their artwork. And while I'm saying this, as you guys are listening to this, pop over to WalkingStick69 on Instagram and check out, Bill posts the artwork he gets, and just check out some of this artwork. And there's a lot to discuss on some of that artwork, but that relationship of trust that you have with these people, put aside the morality of cashing in on that. How hard was it just to get your foot in the door with them in the first place, much less, you know, sell it $100, you know, make a quick $100 on them and then hope to talk to them right again, you know?
Right. So, I mean, as a lot of people do in their jobs, you know, when they first start out, it's trial and error. I failed many times. You know, I went right into death row. Okay. What'd you do? Why'd you do it? This and that. And they shut down instantly. I'm like, okay, I'm doing something wrong. So, the counseling aspect of the degree taught me to say less and listen more. And then the psychology of it taught me how to be, and it's really not the greatest thing to admit, but it taught me to be a better liar. So when I walk into death row, you know, pretty much everything about me is a lie, in the sense of I can't show any emotion. I can't show any reaction, because they want that. They look for that, you know, and I use a lot of humor. So if I talk to the ones on death row, whether they killed 20 people, 50 people, 2 people, you know, I'll still joke with them. Like, if they'll say, are you ever going to ask me what I did? And I mean, yeah, obviously you're not here for jaywalking, because we wouldn't have this discussion. You're no different than anybody else. And then they go into the, well, I'm a little bit better than this and this and this. And I'm like, well, you still suck because you got caught. So let's, and then, so when you call them out on stuff like that, then they know that you're for real. But then they'll, you know, they're very manipulative. I mean, these guys have nothing but time on their hands. And when I say they have time on their hands, they have time on their hands out of their cells doing what most people have no idea death row inmates can do. So they spend more time out of their cells for the most part than they do in. they have tablets. They can call all the time, which they do. They email me all the time. They write me letters. They send me paintings. They're very needy. That being said, they also network prison to prison, outside world as well. So when they ask me personal questions, you know, where did my kids go to college at, or when they graduate, or where are they living in that, they're asking me questions that they already know the answers to. So they're testing me. So I don't ever lie to them. And they've checked me out and they know that. So sometimes I'll get letters from a serial killer or a mass murderer or whatever, say, hey, so-and-so says you're a stand-up guy. I'm going to have you checked out. If you check out, you'll hear from me. And then that's it. And then I'll hear from them. So I don't really solicit them as much anymore as like I used to, you know, 15 years ago. Now they seek me out because they know I don't sell anybody out. And, you know, whatever they tell me pretty much stays. They know I do certain podcasts. There's a couple of serial killers that you and I both know that we're dealing with on some, you know, body counts. And I've had these maps in my possession now for quite some time. And hopefully with, you know, your expertise and willingness and, you know, Caitlin and Henry and the people from Wise Fool Films, we'll be able to bring some closure to some families, you know. So, but I don't put that stuff out there on the social media aspect. And people, I encourage them to go to my Instagram and Facebook. They'll see some, just a snippet of some of the art. I mean, I have tons of art on there, but that's only when I get 20 pieces a week. I may post two or three. They can DM me, instant message me or whatever, and ask me more about it. But I try not to put any names out there because of the fact that I just don't glorify them.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's got to be such a tightrope to walk. And not only, you know, you're known. So you've got once you establish those bona fides, you've got this very unique group of individuals in our entire society and you're their point of contact, And it's, as they're facing this, they're facing, you know, their mortality in the execution phase. Is it, that they kind of want their stories known, or is it like you said, they've got nothing but time and they sometimes want to mess with you, or is it genuinely you've established that you have a connection with them and you just want to understand? Or I kind of wonder motivation. Yeah. Like you said, these guys are always got an angle, and I wonder motivation sometimes.
Sure. So what I've discovered over the years is the one thing that they fear a lot of is to be forgotten. You know, when I first started, everybody had to admit to me that they were guilty before I would discuss anything with them. Because if they were claiming innocence, then, you know, you need to speak to an attorney. You know, the last thing you want to do is speak to me, because everything that you tell me is fair game. And I was shocked that every single person admitted without remorse. And then I switched over to, okay, even if they don't admit it, maybe I'll still try to get inside their head. What's it like to live in there if you think you're innocent? And I'll be honest with you, the only one that's claimed their innocence the entire time would be Scott Peterson, who I talk to on a regular basis. But every one of my guys, they have no qualms about it, you know. Again, this one's on me, but if I get mail and I open it, even email. So if I looked at my four different email accounts, because they have different ones, you know, whether it's JPay or Getting Out or Securus or whatever like that, I haven't checked it in probably like 2 weeks. And so I'll probably have 20, 30 of them on there right now, and they'll be worried about me. Where are you at? What, is everything okay? How's your health? So I find that fascinating in the sense of you killed 15 people that you knew or didn't know, but you're worried about my health. Why? You know, plus I always feel like then I have to respond. So I have letters like laying around, like I just, when I sat down, I even forgot about this one because it's been here for a couple of weeks from Charles Ng, and it's never been open. But so Charles Ng's a pretty well-known guy. I think he killed like 25 people. And I've never opened. I guess I can open it now just to see what he has to say. But usually he's a very depressed individual, has, you know, something to say, or that he'll send me some artwork, or he'll hope that I'm doing well or something like that. But he's actually Looks like he's getting praise for, oh, I'm sending you my greeting in the year of the dragon, because he is he's from originally from Hong Kong, okay. Served in the Marines, and then he got hooked up with Leonard Lake, and then kidnapped a lot of people and held them as sex slaves. Thank you for the letter to let me know that you were okay. the compliments on my artwork, because he is a very, very good artist. I look forward to sending you some more soon. In the meantime, I am busy packing up and getting ready for my new home and my new landlord. I will send you more masterpieces for your collection soon. Take care. Best wishes, Charles. So a lot of them are getting transferred out of San Quentin, you know, where they go to San Diego or Donovan or wherever. And then, of course, for security reasons, they won't say ahead of time. So I'll just be on the lookout for whenever he sends more stuff. And at some point, I'll go out there and meet with him. But I don't like to go out and meet with them and not get something from them if it's going to be more of a body count or things like that. I'm not the one to sit around and just, you know, high five them and take pictures and then bash them on social media like some people do. So
yeah,
I try to keep that stuff kind of private. So and as you well know, I mean, it's a nasty world out there. So, you know, when we get ourselves enmeshed in this, you know, we have to be prepared to, it's all in. So that's,
yeah. And once you're part of it, it doesn't seem like it's one of those things you can just be like, well, I'm done. This project's over. You know, it's right. Because then you incur their wrath, right? And I mean, they might be behind bars, but they can, like you said, they got all the time in the world.
And they have a lot of people on the outside, you know? Yeah. So unless everybody's in prison for life or they put everybody to death, there's a lot of connections. And so I'll be honest with you. I respect them. I respect them very, very highly. And then they give me respect back. Those that have provided us with the maps to the bodies know that we'll be digging them up or locating them and hopefully bringing closure to those families. So that's not a surprise to them. They have a large body count anyways. There may be ulterior motives for them to maybe extend their, keep from being put to death sooner. Who knows? But the consistency of the one serial killer with the same maps here in Florida and in Ohio, they have never changed over the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. And I've had him to draw them in pencil, paint them for me, everything. And they are identical every time. So, to the point where he's upset that we haven't done anything yet still.
Yeah.
Because he has more bodies out there.
That's just, it's fascinating to me. And yeah, we could touch on it. Cause it's, when you brought it up the first time we're talking, I was just amazed that, that authorities didn't jump on it. Like the ability, right. Like you said, the ability to bring a family, some kind of end to the story. I don't know if closure ever helps, because it's not like they're going to feel better now that they know, right. You know, it's still going to hurt every day, like a bandage getting torn off, but to finally be able to put that part of their family to rest, finally, you know, on their terms. But yeah, you've got, and it's, I'm not going to bring up names unless you want to, but the guy you're talking about has offered you where he's got bodies laying that have never been claimed or found, and given you the ability to go find them, and you couldn't find traction with law enforcement to go and do this, which it infuriates me on one side, because I can't imagine saying no to this. I mean, I understand resources being what they are, but to get that and just jump in the car, go find a lead and just get a feel for if it's, or at least a follow-up interview, if he's willing to talk to you, why not have a follow-up with the guy?
I was shocked. I'll be honest with you. And you're talking local and federal level. So, you know, and I keep really good, accurate notes of, you know, when we've spoken with the certain agents and where, and the cards that they've given me and everything else. And the questions that they would give me to ask this individual. In fact, there was another one, Anthony Solwell. We can mention him now that he's dead. He died of COVID a couple years ago. They thought he had some other bodies out there. And they, you know, they gave me questions to ask because they won't talk to law enforcement. They'll talk to me. I knew he didn't have any desire to give up anything else if there were any out there. But the other guy was, and he's given me maps to Ohio and Florida. And he's like, you know, there's more out there, but until you guys do something, why should I waste my time on giving you more? And he's got a point. I mean, you know, why? But we still stay in contact. He sends me art. He worries about my health. He just sent me 4 paintings, I think, last week or something. So, I mean, we have a really good understanding. But until we get the ball rolling on getting some of these victims recovered, I'm hoping sooner than later because, you know, his time will be running out.
Yeah. And yeah, and the crazy thing is whenever you say that, I always go back to on every crime scene team, they, you know, the FBI ERT, the MCIOs, their crime scene teams, the MCRTs, they need training. Like the team gets together on a semi-annual quarterly basis and goes out and goes, like when I was on ERT in the bureau in the wintertime, we'll go out to a ski resort. We'll, you know, set up a crime scene and work it so we can get used to working in snow. We'll get together and we'll go work a scene or work the cameras or do something. Every team has to go practice. Every team has to go run an exercise. And for them to just be like, you know what are we going to do this fall? Why don't we grab the ERT together and just go chase this lead and see what happens? You know, it's
right.
It's the time's already built in. It's just, come
you
on.
Know, worst case scenario, you don't locate anything, but you got some training, you know?
Yeah, you got some training. Yep. And exhuming a body is not a normal thing. It's not like It's not like every crime scene text is like, oh, I dug up a body last week. It's no big deal. They bury bodies all the time.
Right. You know, and if I had a dollar for every time everybody always said, oh, I'd love to go with you and we'll go dig it up. It doesn't work that way. It's not a treasure hunt. You're talking about human life, number one. And number two, you know, there's a lot at stake. There's a lot involved. So, you know, say hypothetically, you know, me and a buddy go out there and we start digging around. Well, say we found something. Well, at that point, it's instantly a crime scene. So you're done. It's over. You have to back away. It's not like you can bring in the movie cameras and dig it up and say, oh, see, we told you so. No, at that point, it's over. Not to mention, you kind of like to have to get permission to go on certain pieces of property and cross other pieces of property. And this guy was smart enough to locate them on hard to reach places. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it's doable. I'm hoping so. Caitlin and Henry and Rylan and that the production company that, you know, Wise Fools, they're on it. They're hustling it. But, you know, when you keep getting the same responses from law enforcement that, you know, if they weren't prostitutes, if they weren't drug addicts, then maybe. And that's so sad. You know, I dealt with Samuel Little for a long time there for a while. And he reached out to me because we were from the same. I taught in the area he was born in and his best friends lived in my hometown. So he reached out to me. And then I think I have a portrait of one of his that was never recovered as well. And it's weird because nobody's ever really reached out to me on trying to recover that one either. So
I talked to Jillian Lauren last year. She wrote a book. Yeah. She sat down with Samuel and wrote a lot of, did a great job on identifying some of his people. And the whole term of no human involvement is just such a black eye, you know?
Yeah.
And it's,
to that Texas Ranger who was able to convince him to sit down and just speak openly about it. Because you don't find the law enforcement willing to do that, it seems like anymore. And I don't know Jillian personally, but she has reached out to me because when Sam died, they sent me a bunch of mail that they didn't know who else to send it to. So, you know, and and I had been in constant contact. And then I know she wanted that portrait. But, you know, again, I wanted to mean something. I don't want it hung on a wall somewhere. I wanted to be used to locate. Because I've always said to everybody that when I'm finally able to walk away from this, I am done. You won't find death row art hanging on my walls anywhere. I don't display it. I just, there's a few paintings here and there that they've done of my book covers or certain things like that, that maybe my wife has liked, but when you're talking thousands of pieces of art laying around and stored in, sort of, I have enough to open up an entire gallery, but number one, I don't know anything about art. And number two, I could care less about it.
Yeah. And to but make
they
it do. A trophy,
they send it in human blood. They send it, it made out of semen and everything else stuff, directly to my wife, just to get that, that jolly off, I guess, of trying to get that shock and all, but nothing shocks her or the kids anymore because they've been around it forever. So.
Yeah. But there's some, like, if you guys haven't looked, go to Walking Stick 69. There's some that's just amazing work. And yeah. I guess if you've got time to, and what I'm showing him is one Tears of Death, and it's just a portrait of an eye, but it's incredibly detailed, and it's a tear with a skull in it, dripping down the face, and it's just the some of the detail just is insane, and a couple others look like they're like watercolor landscapes that you just
the little smiley face there, the little thing or whatever that's hiding the name of the person that you and I have the maps for. So I try to, because, sometimes they'll sign on the front of it. Other times they don't. And I try to cover up that signature so people don't reach out and do whatever.
Yeah. It's just, but when we were talking the last time, I was flipping through the artwork and it's like, man, is it, when it comes to the artwork, it's not like these guys are artists going in, is it just like how they, is it like part of their assigned therapy or something, or is it a way they spend the time in prison, or how do they
get
into
it? Make money
is that oh yeah that's
yeah
so it's part of huge, the part of the game
huge huge money so you know I'll get and it happens, believe it or not, it happens. I think last week or week before, when I went to the post office, even though I have a post office box, a lot of the artwork in that, because they'll say do not bend or you can't bend it or stuff's just so big, they'll put it in bigger boxes or lockers in it. So I had three of them because I hadn't checked it in like a week and a half. Prior to that, like 2 weeks before, I had a key in there to say, go to locker number 28. And I take pictures of everything. So I went to locker 28. The lock was missing.
Uh-oh.
So inside the United States Post Office, somebody had decided to bust the lock off of that one. And the locker was empty and they couldn't even explain it. So, stuff gets stolen either from the prison or from the guards in there, and they'll sell it. Or if it makes it to the post office, somewhere in between, it gets, because it's marked right on their death row. So, and people know. So there's a lot of money to be made, especially from people in Europe and all over, because they don't have death penalty over there. And they're just fascinated with killers, and they'll see the art and they see, how beautiful some of it really is. And they'll pay big money for it, whether it's to the, now some of them will have deals with them on the inside anyways. So say hypothetically, I had a deal worked out with Ng or something, like, okay, you send me your artwork, I'll sell it and we'll split it, 70-30. And, so they'll do it that way even. When you see those murderabilia sites and the serial killer sites and all that stuff, a lot of times it's a wheel and deal kind of thing. So, it's a way to make money. So there's a lot of money on death row.
Wow. That's the whole economy. I didn't even think of that. I mean, I got the murderabilia thing, but to think the dudes, once he realizes he's on death row, he's like, I'm going to learn how to paint. And yeah. I guess if you're an artist, you don't have to be good at it. You just have to, it's all in the eye of the beholder.
And then some of them,
your name carries enough.
Yeah. And then other ones like this serial killer who's working, we're working on the other bodies. I don't know if the people can see it or not, but it's all glass beads.
Yeah.
So, so he sent this one for my wife, and they're all glass to go with the bracelet that he sent me a couple months ago, but the bracelet had, beads from all different inmates on death row that they gave to him to make the bracelet to send to me, because they know that I'll hang on to it. And some of them are dead now because of, you know, executions or, you know, natural causes. But when you're talking 15 different death row inmates, different beads, you know, to them, it means something. To me, I look at it from a psychological aspect. You know, it means a lot to me to see what they've done to, you know, come together to send that to me. Mm-hmm. But as far as value wise, I mean, I wouldn't know what to sell something like that for. I mean, I don't even know why anybody would want to buy it, but they do.
Yep. And that's on Instagram too. You guys, if you want to scroll through, it's that it, I'm looking at it right now, but, that that's the whole thing's just fascinating that, well, it, you know, how does your wife take it? Like when a piece of jewelry shows up with, you know, 10 different samples from serial killers, she's like, oh, man, what did I get myself into?
No, she'll look at it and she's like, oh, not him again. Or the guy that paints it, when he sends her the artwork with semen, she's like, oh, not David again. She can look at a piece of art and know exactly who it's from, because she's the one that catalogs them all. So there's nobody she doesn't know there. They've all wanted her to come to death row with me. She's been approved to go to death row in Florida and all over. And she's like, I am not, I'm a school teacher, for Christ's sakes. I'm not doing any of that. So, but they respect her in a sense of, they invite her. They don't try to degrade her or anything other than the guy with the semen paintings, but you know, he's different all in himself. But, she doesn't think twice about it. If anything, she's like, I got to put all that away, and now I got to catalog it. The kids, they could care less. Every now and then, you know, my son will be like, hey, I haven't had an Ollie or a Kobe done in a while. Have so-and-so do it for me. I'm like, all right, fine, so I will. Or my daughter will be like, hey, you know, I could really use one of these. Okay, fine. So, because they love it when I request stuff, too. It's weird. Yeah.
So it's got to be kind of like validating for them, like you know, getting reciprocation in that relationship. They're just like, oh yeah,
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 absolutely. Where I think other people think, oh my God, if they knew where I lived or if they knew my kids or whatever, I don't know how I would be able to, you know, go out without a gun or anything else. Well, I have bad news for you. If you've written anybody and they've written you back, they've already checked you out. So yeah. I mean, it's your information is out there. Yeah, I keep a post office box, but they'll send me stuff to my house. So when Caitlin and Henry and them were here the first time to do the sizzle reel, I happened to have a great big box sent to, from the only female Native American on death row. And it was huge. It was sent right to my house. And how she got my house address, I have no idea, but you know, I thanked her for it and everything. And they'll do that every now and then just to let you know, hey, we know.
America. Yeah, just a push, just a little bit of a push to let you know they have power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's why I try to discourage people who, you know, what I just spoke at Heidelberg University last week, I believe, in Ohio, or the week before. And it never fails. All the students always want to know, hey, how do you get into this? You know, what class do you have to take? How can I do this? You don't. If I had it to do all over again, I probably wouldn't myself, but I had no idea. You're just opening up yourself to a lot of risks, not just for yourself, but for your family. And if you're a selfish type of individual who only wants to do it for profit, then you better figure out what the value of your family is then, because anything that can be out there, they will know about.
So. Yeah. Your motives are just off. Opening that door for the purposes of greed is.
Yeah. People ask me all the time, aren't you ever worried about when you go on death row and everything else? Honestly, yes. I'm always concerned because I'm in their house. I'm in their world. That's, you know, they're in control. But I'm safer now than if I wasn't doing it at all, compared to if I never started before. So if I stopped today and I cut ties with everybody, that's when I would start getting nervous. So that's why I've tried to limit the ones that I've reached out to or reached back out to. I really don't want any newer cases, so to speak, to study I would like the ones that I have to eventually dissipate. And that makes it easier for me to just retire from it all. Because the moment I stop, the moment I get rid of all this art, sell it, do whatever, then that's when I have to worry.
Yeah. And that stress has got to be constantly there. And it's just, just, there's nothing you can do about it. No.
Yep. And you don't want to live your life that way. So, I mean, it is what it is. I got myself into it. I asked for it. I'll do what I can. And then I'll move on.
Well, and there's a lot to be learned from it. I mean, not only for your students, for the whole reason you got into it in the first place, but have you ever like worked when you're talking about, you know, every time you go give a talk, there's always somebody who wants to know how to get into this. And it reminds me, I was kind of chuckling to myself, but every intern I've ever had in federal law enforcement always got into it because they want to be an FBI profiler.
Right. Oh my God.
Every one of them. I'm going to be an FBI profiler. I'm like, no, you're not. You're just not.
No. So when people go to my Instagram or whatever, or Facebook, I'll use hashtags, you know, like true crime author and, you know, death row and everything else. And usually somewhere in there, it'll say not in all capital letters, fake, and then hashtag profiler. Cause I'm not a profiler. There's guys out there that I know that claim to be and everything else and have no training whatsoever. But you know, they know it all because they've talked to a killer here or a killer there in that. So
they read Mindhunters and then followed up with Whoever Fights Monsters, and now they can profile anybody.
So everybody wants to be an FBI profiler agent. They want to get in the field right away, and and you would know more than myself or anybody else out there that it just doesn't work that way.
Not the way it works.
It's like when somebody gets they go to school for criminal justice and they want to graduate with a degree and join the police force as a detective instantly because they know
that's everything. That's the second one. I'll get the interns and be like, yeah, I'm graduating next year. And they're like, what should I do? I was like, you should go join a police department and work patrol for about 5 years. And they're like, yeah, I don't really want to be in patrol. I'm like, you're in the wrong business. I hate to tell you, that's the best part. Night shift on patrol is the best time you'll ever have. every time, man. But man, sorry, my camera got loopy. Hold on a second. There we go. All right, there. Now I'm not squiggly. It wasn't your eyes. It was my camera.
Okay.
So when you and thinking about these guys, when you mentioned Ng, Charles Ng. That'd be quite a name. But
right.
So he was part of a duo, and I've never understood the duos. Like, it feels like when you read about them, it's like one's a follower, one's a leader. But have you ever, like, I don't know how deep in the discussions you get with these guys, but how does that idea come up? Like, they're just sitting around drinking beers one night and be like, you know what I could do? I could really go for kidnapping a hooker and torturing her for a weekend. Like,
you know, it is odd because it would take two very eccentric personalities to, first of all, connect in that way. Ng was in the Marines, kind of like an outcast anyways. And then you have somebody like Leonard Lake, who I honestly don't know a whole lot about, because the moment he was arrested, you know, they took him into interrogation. He said he was going to confess to everything, asked for a bottle of water, something like that. They didn't realize he had a cyanide tablet stuck up underneath his collar. He took that and he died. Ng took off, crossed the border, went to Canada, and they actually allowed him to be extradited back, even with the death penalty on the table. Most countries wouldn't even do that. So I find it very fascinating because they were two different personalities. I mean, Leonard Lake almost looked like the lumberjack type, and Ng was definitely the follower, but obviously had some skills to him because, you know, he was in the Marines. You know, there was quite a few of my guys. You know, Anthony Solwell was in the Marines as well. There's quite a few of them that had that training. So then in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, is there a connection in that sense of, you know, did the military do something to twist your thought processes going into it like that. But then that really doesn't make much sense either, because you're not kidnapping, raping, torturing, and videotaping it until you're bored with them and then moving on to the next victim. So
yeah.
I know people would love the answers to all of those, but unfortunately, there's just certain things that we will never understand about these type of serial killers, just like they can't understand you and I. So we'll look at Ng and we'll look at Lake and we'll look at Raider and all of them and say, those guys are just bizarre. What is it about them? And they look at us and think the same thing. You know, John is bizarre. Bill is bizarre. Why do they have all these feelings and emotions and empathy?
Yeah.
It's just a human. It doesn't matter. A sin is a sin. If you steal a candy bar, if you murder somebody, there's no difference in their mind.
Yeah.
So that's why I think that it's more biological than it is a learned behavior. It would be very difficult to teach somebody to want to be a serial killer. Not to say that everybody doesn't have the ability to harm another person or to kill another person, but we usually have that impulse control. They do not. They also have that something organic going on in their brain that allows them to not have that feeling of sorrow or sadness. But in fact, they enjoy watching, from the serial killers I've dealt with, they actually enjoy watching the life leave the body of the person. That's why when they strangle them or suffocate them, they're facing them. They love that that feeling, you know. And then, you know, the majority of them are also necrophiliacs, so they'll go back and have sex with them when they're dead. So they do progress, but at some point throughout their lifetime, they were, you know, I have the entire case file on Dahmer, the original one from Park Dietz and everything, his psychological reports, his writing sentences, everything in his writing. I have all of that. And I'm still trying to wrap my brain around that one, because of the fact that, you know, my son played basketball at the same high school that he went to. He would practice, and my son went to Ohio State. My daughter went to Ohio State, right where Dahmer was at. And so, you know, there's that connection, even though that case is done. And from the psychological aspect, I'm looking at the MMPI that they put him through and all these other tests. And, you know, his confessions of why he wanted to turn them into zombies and how and what acid that he used and everything. To me, it's hard for me to compute, because I'm not in his world. I'm not in his mindset, and never will be, hopefully.
So. Yeah. And it's like there's just a void there where, like you said, that empathy and that humanity is, just not there. It's very
right.
But it's
in his words, he was looking for a way to take control of a human that would be at his beck and call, his sex slave, kind of like Leonard Lake and Charles Ng, but they were doing it forcibly by, you know, confining them, where Dahmer was, you know, trying to remove the skull and pour acid in a diluted solution to make them zombies to where they wouldn't leave them. He didn't want to be left alone. They just wanted to, you know, enjoy themselves in their sadistic, evil way, get rid of that person and find the next one. So one might have enjoyed more of the hunt. The other one might have enjoyed more of the captivity and the sex aspect of it. So, and I think the toolbox killers and people like that could be the same way. But I'd be very wary of anybody on TV who says, oh yeah, this is exactly why, or they diagnose them as this without ever meeting them, because
talk to them.
It takes, never talk to them. And it would take hours and hours and hours. And reading through these psychological reports and psychiatric reports from Park Dietz and all of them, they've spent, you know, probably 100 hours with Dahmer at that time to go through all of this stuff. So for somebody to be on national TV and watch a video and say, oh yeah, I can tell that this one's a narcissistic individual and this one is a sociopath and a psychopath, and I just shake my head at it, because there's just no way to determine that.
Yeah. It's so hard to watch those. It's,
oh, it is.
Yeah. Everybody still does, but it's rough at my house, 'cause I've got a nurse And then me in the law enforcement world. So when it comes to settling on something for TV, it's like, man, if I'm not arguing with the TV on how their technical advisor should have more say, she's arguing with the actors because they're not wearing gloves inside the sterile field and they're not holding the scalpel the right way. And it's like, how about we just find stand-up comedy? Can we just find stand-up comedy and just settle on
that? Wendy and I can never agree on TV. We just can't. We can't agree on dinner or TV. So, and I would like, everybody always wants to get my wife on their show or their podcast because they want her perspective, and she's never done one in her life yet. Just like I would love to talk to your wife on the medical aspect of it, because when I go to these executions, and you have to remember, you would not have any of these debatable topics when it comes to putting him to death in a humane way if you take the medical aspect out of it. So when we had the electric chair, when we had the firing squad, when we had the gas chamber or the gallows, there was nothing medical involved. The moment you brought the medical field into it with the drugs or the gases like the nitrogen and things like that, all of a sudden, then it becomes debatable because no medical professional, your wife included, would be allowed to partake in that. Mm-hmm. So it's prison staff, EMTs, and things like that. So of course they're going to get it wrong. And there's always going to be something botched because they're not trained professionals. They're not anesthesiologists. They're not registered nurses. They're not anything like that. So they're getting whatever they're getting. And that's what creates this huge dilemma of the drug companies not wanting to supply it and the gas companies and this and that, where if they want to get rid of that debate, you go to the methods that remove the medical aspect of it.
Yeah.
And I think that it should be much more transparent so people can see what is involved in the process of putting a human being to death. They want it to look humane only for the public's viewing of it all, to say that we're doing it the most humane way possible in the United States.
Yeah.
But realistically, we have no idea. You know, it's just they're suffering.
No control.
I've seen them. The first execution I attended was 2 hours long. First drug wore off, so the guy was, you know, gasping and convulsing or whatever. And I'm like, I didn't sign up for this. I was told it was going to be like a putting a dog down. And then you'll hear veterinarians come out there and say, well, I would never even put a dog down using that chemical or that, you know, gas, whatever. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, well, you wouldn't electrocute your dog either. You wouldn't put him in the firing squad. So it's, you can't really compare it that way. So why are we having that type of a conversation? Why don't we, if the goal is to never have that person hurt another person on the outside, putting them in prison for life without parole, I think that accomplishes. But
and takes away all that, all those variables are gone. Yeah.
Because like you said earlier in the program, there's no such thing as closure, really, especially if you're waiting 20, 30 years and the majority of the victim's family members have already passed on. And then all of a sudden, okay, we're going to put this person to death. And now what? Now they can say, okay, it's over with, and they can start their grieving process then. 20 years ago, my advice to them from a professional aspect would be, as hard as it would be, just put them out of your mind. Don't let them rent space in your head. Don't let them have anything in your mind, because that's part of what they like to do. They want to drag you into the appeals. They want to have you relive that over and over. They get off on that. I mean, I have pictures of actual murder scenes, the real ones, not photographs, but the actual evidence, where they'll tape them to the back of the paintings because it's the actual evidence. So when they fire their attorneys and they represent themselves, then they're allowed to have that discovery. Yeah. And then they'll start sneak it to me. Yeah. And they just really want to get off on that stuff. And, you know, I got, they're horrible, horrible pictures where the guys, you know, been shanked in prison and, you know, brutally cut up and everything else. And I have the whole photo album of it. And I'm thinking, okay, what are we doing here? I mean, why are we worried about the appeals process? Put him away, put that person away, let the family grieve and move on. so they don't have to continuously go to these appeals and have to relive that case again.
Yeah, so. And I've had a couple of people on here to talk about it. Rod Sadler was one of them, talking about victims' rights has come about a bit better in the last 10, 15 years, but every time there's a motion, those victims are the victims' families are reliving every time. So the only person suffering through this whole thing is the families of these victims, because the bad guy's not suffering. He's like you said, he's hanging on his iPad all day long, watching daytime all day soaps all day long.
He's in the yard. Good. He's doing, single cell, not having anything worried about. And I'm assuming that eventually when we start the filming process, and maybe they'll show us going into the prison, you and I, and we'll be talking to the same individual that if we went to right now, there's no handcuffs, there's no shackles, we're high-fiving it, we can eat from the canteen, everything else. But the moment the cameras are there, they're going to probably have them behind glass, shackles, and everything else. So it makes it appear that they're safe and secure and locked up at all times. Yeah. And that's the biggest myth that, and when I go to San Quentin, you're locked in the same cages, you know, so you're just locked in the cell, basically, one-on-one. There's no movement. In Florida, there's 25 of death row inmates at any given time, and we're walking all over. You can get pizza and ice cream and, you know, high-fiving, get your pictures taken. These guys have nothing to lose, nothing to lose. There's one guard who's probably worked an 18-hour shift, because I've seen him sleeping before, and they're just dead tired. So they're overworked, they're underpaid, and the inmates run the asylum, but it's a very controlled setting until you do something that upsets them.
Yeah, or they just wake up on the wrong side of the bed and decide today's my day.
Yes.
And nothing stopping them. Now, you mentioned I don't usually keep anybody till past an hour, but you mentioned, these executions are not medically supervised. They're run by prison staff for legal reasons. Yes. They can't have somebody who's taken the Hippocratic Oath administering death. Have you ever talked to these prison officials who preside over these executions to talk about the stress involved in them having that role, or how they take upon that role, or?
So I mean,
that's
got to
cost you a little bit.
So this is another sad reality. So the first time I asked the guards, and it was in Lucasville, Ohio. They were very, very cordial, very nice to me. But and I felt like any time I talk to a prison guard, it usually would be at the execution. I try not to ever converse with any of the guards on any death row during a visit or anything like that, because for obvious reasons, I don't want the inmates seeing me talking to a prison guard. Those guys will go on and sign up for that detail in order to get the next day off with pay. Oh. So basically, a human life is worth a day off of pay.
Worth a day off with pay.
Yes. Now, the first execution, I literally watched the one guard's hand was shaking so bad that he could not connect the tube to the other end of the catheter. And the one guy had to hold his hand steady enough to do that. So in my mind, that's the stuff I'm looking at the entire time. And you can hear a pin drop in that execution chamber. So there's a physician there that you never see, and you never see the executioner. They're behind a wall. The curtain will close when they believe that the body is or the person is dead. The doctor will come out, pronounce them dead, and then leave the room, and then the curtain opens back up. They also have that physician there with a crash cart just in case the phone rings or something does go wrong and they need to intervene. But I've never seen the executioner or the physician, and there are no nurses or anything like that. So
yeah, wow. A human life is worth a day off with pay. That's wild. Didn't see that coming. If there's anybody who needs to be infuriated as you listen to this, that's probably the best reason right there.
Yes.
Wow. I did not see that coming, but man, Well, yeah. Man, I'm really glad you came back, and I think we could probably keep going about 6 hours tonight before I run out of questions. You live in a world, you live in a fascinating world. And I, man, if you hear from Caitlin or anybody else that wants to go chase this down, that'd be a wild process. Just the research involved and then the process involved in getting to actually trying to find some of these unidentified victims. Sounds exhausting, but it'd be such a, there'd be such a win there for, those surviving family members, just to get that resolution. I hope it comes about for you, and I hope you want some help. So,
listen, I can't do it without you. So yeah, you already know that. And I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, man, I agree. And anytime you want to come back, if Wendy ever wants to come hang out on a podcast, I'm down.
I'll let her know.
I don't know if she'd want to. I don't know if she wants to open that door, but
well, she might have to see her deal take. With you. She might have to make a deal with you, and then your wife would have to be on it as well. Then,
right? Yeah, so yeah.
It would be her first one.
Yep. Yeah. I think I'd probably be able to swing that. But no, it's anytime you want, reach out and come back on. We can do this again.
It's an honor every time to talk to you, and I can't wait to work with you in person, man.
So. Absolutely. And everybody, if you didn't go already, go to Instagram, WalkingStick69, and check out Bill's some of the art that he posts. It's fascinating, and I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Good night, everybody.